Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. Good to have you listening to NPR News today because I know our climate change coverage is a priority to our audience. Our guest suggests that those words I just used, climate change, are imprecise, misleading even, when we're talking about what's happening to the planet. He argues that we sharpen and animate our words to reflect the profound disruption that we have unleashed on the world. More on that in a moment. David Pogue also makes the case in his new book that although Sunbelt cities like Atlanta, Austin, and Phoenix are growing fast, we Northerners, with our ubiquity of freshwater lakes and cool temperatures, are well positioned for the decades to come. The world has changed, Mr. Pogue writes in his introduction, and it will keep changing for the rest of your life. It's time to prepare. As David Pogue joins us, I'd like to hear from you about the changes in whatever field or place you're in that you've already observed as a result of a warming world. Places that you walk and swim, maybe that you farm, that you bicycle, that you love in the Midwest. What are you seeing? What does it portend for the years to come? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. David Pogue is a science journalist for CBS Sunday Morning. The new book is titled, How to Prepare for Climate Change, and he joins us this morning from Connecticut. David, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
You argue, as I said, that climate change and global warming just don't really explain what's happening, and I think you suggest the word chaos is a better description. Give us a little context on that.
I know the word global warming makes it sound like it's just a matter of hotter summers and warmer winters. It's not. The warming Earth triggers this domino effect of interconnected natural cycles. So, you know, it's not the congressman walking into Congress with a snowball and saying, "You're telling me the warmth is gaining on us." it's freak heat and freak snowstorms. It's droughts and intense rains. It's flooding and water shortages. It's all kinds of stuff that you wouldn't even expect to be related to global warming, like more kidney stones, smaller goats, more expensive chocolate. I mean, virtually everything is affected. So, yeah, I think global warming is too mild and too one-directional to communicate well to the public.
I think what is also confusing is we have our own powers of observation, which, as you can hear, I'm tapping into for our audience this morning. But some of this is beneath the surface, slow rolling, right? Some of the consequences of this has already begun, has been gathering for a while. And yet, you know, there aren't headlines to say, as you just said, smaller goats, and it's the reason of climate change. I think we confuse what is happening in kind of a slow process with some of the, now we all see what this means. How do you report on that to connect the dots, I guess?
Oh, you said it. We as a species evolved to react to sudden dangers. You know, we're good at running away from a bear, but it's the slow, continuous future stuff we're not so good at. That's why we still smoke. That's why we still, you know, have obesity problems. That's why we don't insure properly. So it's hard for us to take action based on slow moving effects. That said, we did see a number of records broken in 2020. It was tied for the hottest year ever recorded. The hottest temperature ever recorded on the planet was in the United States. It was 130 degrees in Death Valley. We had so many hurricanes that we ran out of the alphabetical boys and girls names and had to start using Greek letters to name them. We had, you know, the hurricanes hit new devastation too, not just quantity, but quality. And of course, the wildfires out west ate up the equivalent of Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Delaware all in one season. So we are starting to see the effects. It is starting to become an imminent threat.
I'm going to come back to heat in particular, because one of your statistics is just startling. But let's go to the calls here, to Mike in Edina. Hi, Mike. Good to have you on the line.
Hi. Hello.
Hi. Your observation on this.
Yeah. I have a number of grandchildren, but one in particular, 11-year-old, who has a history of asthma. And I've been called to help on a number of occasions when he's had a worsening of his asthma. And as a physician, I've noted that these tend to occur on poor air quality days, of which we are seeing a number of, particularly from the exhaust of transportation and from the wildfires out west. And those particulates work their way across the continent, and it's wreaking just a lot of havoc on the health of people, particularly with asthma, and COPD, and other respiratory diseases.
Yeah, Mike, I think what you're saying here is a good example, David, is what we were talking about. Okay, so there's an uptick in a certain year of people who show up at the ER with the problems of Mike's grandson. Now you get you maximize those numbers and you look at what that means across the country, and then you're starting to see the shape of the implications of that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We all learned as children about the water cycle, about how water evaporates from the oceans, goes into the air, forms clouds, and rains back down. 93% of the new heat from the changing climate has gone into the oceans. So there is a point to this, but it's the domino effect I was talking about. So you get more humidity in the air, that triggers more bacteria and mold, and that triggers more asthma. We're looking at 4.6 million more cases of asthma in American homes just from the dampness and the mold of the more humid climate.
Yeah. Dr. Penny Edgel says on Twitter, ponds filled with green algae due to the runoff from fertilizer used on fields and residential lawns. Maggie says, you could explain to people how polar vortexes develop as a consequence of climate change. We should bring this up for a moment, David, because I think many of our listeners are clear about what's weather and what is climate chaos. But we get into a cycle like we're in right now in the United States, that can be a little confusing. Is the science clear about how the jet stream behaves in accordance with what's happening with climate change?
It's getting there. The planet warms mostly, well, fastest at the poles. And so as the poles warm, it wreaks all kinds of havoc. As they call it Arctic amplification, the fact that the Arctic warms twice as fast as every place else. Partly that's because of the ice that covers the water is melting away. And famously, that ice is white, which normally reflects the sun. But now, of course, you're replacing it with black or dark seawater, and that makes everything warm up faster. And of course, because of that old water cycle, that generates warmer, more moist air masses over the Arctic, and suddenly the whole wind streams are affected.
Yeah, I want to note what you've said in the introduction to the book about heat, and this really took me aback. For as much as I read about climate science, by 2070, 19% of the planet's land surface will be uninhabitably hot. I mean, are those the places that right now we associate with extreme heat? I'm thinking of the Middle East, maybe parts of Southeast Asia. Or are we going to move into places that at the moment seem habitable, but will not be habitable in 50 years?
It is the places you would think about. It's, of course, it always winds up being the poorer countries. It's the Middle East, it's parts of Africa, it's Southeast Asia. And as things dry up and become unfarmable, people have to move. They have to go somewhere. So it's not just the uninhabitableness of these regions. It's where those people are going to go. And the UN is really concerned about climate migration. We're talking about hundreds of millions of people having to crowd into more temperate areas, into places that doesn't really have the capacity to accept them. I mean, there is climate migration in the United States. The wildfires and the hurricanes have driven hundreds of thousands of people out of their homes, and some are even moving voluntarily just to escape, you know, the repeated Florida flooding or the hurricanes of the Gulf Coast. And another big chunk of Americans are adding to their considerations of where to move climate change. Your listeners have had the foresight to move to Minnesota, which is, of course, one of the climate havens such as there is in the United States. You don't have the hurricanes or the wildfires. You have moderate temperatures, and I mean, you have cold winters, but they are warming up. They've warmed up about 5 degrees in the last 50 years, so, and it will keep warming up in the winter.
Yeah,
but yeah, there's climate migration everywhere.
We should say the fresh water challenge. I mean, you make a point about access to fresh water and the proximity that we have, you know, here in our lakes and our rivers is really an important asset as climate change increases, and that access to that fresh water is going to shrink for a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you said it. That's the part of where to live, which is the second chapter of how to prepare for climate change that nobody really thinks about. The entire western half of the United States is in a more or less perpetual drought. You know, we get most of our drinking water either from aquifers, which are these big underground storehouses, which are now at historic lows, or from snowmelt from the mountains out west. And they're not getting a lot of snow out west with these warmer winters. Lake Mead, which is the lake formed by the Hoover Dam, gives the water to 25 million people in Nevada and California. It's at 1/3 full. So, yeah, so the beauty of the Great Lakes is that they are great lakes. They will have copious sources of water for decades to come. I would say the greatest problems is with Great Lakes areas is, as we've mentioned, the algae blooms are something to start controlling. But that is within human control, at least.
Agricultural runoff, right? Climate-driven invasive species. I mean, we're worried about all of that up here. David Pogue is with us, if you've just gotten in on the show. He's a science and technology writer and the author of a new book that we're talking about, How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. And I think our powers of observation and then our willingness to take action are important elements of the conversation. So I want to know about the changes that you've observed as a farmer here in the upper Midwest, maybe the places that you walk and swim and bicycle and visit for your vacations. What are you seeing? What do you think it portends for the years to come? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Get in on the discussion via Twitter. It's at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R, to Robert in Aiken County. Hi, Robert. Good to have you on the phone.
Hi.
What'd you want to say?
Well, a lot of stuff, but I'll try to be concise.
okay.
First off, you know, you were talking about water here just a second ago, and yes, we have a lot of water, but you know, there are unmetabolized pharmaceuticals in basically all of our surface waters that come largely from urine. So I'd like to for us to do two things: start to think about this problem in terms of not just climate chaos or climate change, but, global poisoning. It's what we seem to do best as humans. And then we need to be able to think about excuse me, how we address these problems, and that comes down to structural changes in our collective decision-making, which I would like to think would, excuse me, mean that we have to get money out of politics once and for all and end the nonsense of party politics.
Okay. So David, I'm going to take what Robert said there about the political will, because we knew this conversation was headed there eventually. Let's just get there. It is frustrating to watch the years of denial out of Washington and the inability to summon the political will to do some difficult things. But I don't blame it only on Washington. I look back into the citizens of the country and say there are going to eventually be some sacrifices. Perhaps that's financial, perhaps that's behavioral. How do we gather ourselves to prepare for that? Have you thought about that?
I mean, you and your caller are both right. The American system, such as it is structured to continue to make the emissions problem worse, right? We measure our success as Americans by how much we have accumulated, you know, how much we buy, how much we travel. So asking Americans to change their lifestyle for the sake of this somewhat invisible threat is a big ask. I mean, we did just elect a president whose number one or number two priority is climate change, and he's off to a roaring start, of course. So I'm much less depressed about the political will question than I was, say, last year. But it is true that the number one thing you as an individual can do to fight climate change is not changing to LED light bulbs or riding your bike more often. It's joining a group and taking some kind of collective action, those group activities. And it doesn't need to be a presidential election. Even getting involved with your school board to encourage them to teach climate change in school, which 50% of schools do not. It can be your town. It can be your business or your place of worship. I mean, all of these organizations have an effect on emissions, and all of them are affected ultimately by people. So there's a big argument for, if you care, get involved with a larger group.
Yeah, I think this is the tension, because you just said, you know, you're not going to stop climate change by changing to LED bulbs. But then we hear messaging that says, well, collectively, that can make a pretty big difference. Let me grab a call here that I think goes to that, to Phil in Duluth. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. I'm very very impressed that you're putting this program on. I'm very grateful for Mr. Polk for joining us. And I want to just add to the last comment that he made about joining. I think it's really important for us who are feeling overwhelmed by the whole problem to join small, to start small, to think small in the beginning. Because if you start thinking big, you're going to get depressed and quit. My suggestion is to find a friend or a family member to educate yourself with, and then do something in your household or in your community and get your, as it were, get your sea legs. Myself and a friend here in Duluth are holding monthly poetry readings about climate change, and we've enlisted the help of local poets, half a dozen per month or so, plus a climate specialist to give a little 5 or 10 minute presentation.
Wow,
and it seems
cool
to be gathering steam.
Phil, I really love the idea of that, because, David, I don't know if you're the kind of reader that I am, but often literature can tell you truths, hard truths, that you might be willing to accept in the narrative of a story, that coming at somebody straight ahead with science, you know, may be more resistant to. What do you think about what Phil said?
Yeah, you're both right. When it comes to talking to a denier or somebody who is first of all, we have to define denier. I don't think it is somebody who says nothing is changing. I think those numbers of people are vanishingly small. I think a denier these days is just somebody who says, "Oh yeah, that things are changing, but it's a natural cycle. It's got nothing to do with us." So the beauty of an emotional appeal or a creative appeal or a literature appeal is that we have seen study after study prove that bombarding somebody with statistics and numbers and even the science is likely not to change a denier's mind and, in fact, to cause them to retrench, to dig in deeper. So it's always the story that does it. You know, talk about your uncle in Wisconsin. Talk about how your kid can't sleep at night. These are the stories that get to people. And if you don't mind, Kira, I want to just finish up on the notion of personal action, because yeah. I didn't mean to say that taking personal action and changing your LEDs is worthless. It is true that the most effect you can have is by joining a group. But as you say, cumulative action of thousands of people eating less red meat or flying less or taking more public transportation does add up in two ways, not only the obvious way, but also because there's a social contagion effect. So other people see what you're doing and are more likely to imitate you. There's been some great studies on solar panels. The adoption of solar panels in a community is proportional to the number of solar panels it already has. So that says that if you're a neighbor and you see a bunch of solar panels on other people's roofs, you're likely to consider it. So there is this social contagion effect, a cumulative acceleration of individuals making changes.
I want to say something here with you about agriculture and climate chaos, because, of course, the upper Midwest is a big agricultural area and important to food production. 70% of all the world's water is used for agriculture. That is mind-blowing. I'd like to know whether you see urgent enough innovation going on in agriculture to bring those numbers down and really bring farmers, many of whom are conservationists themselves, they rely on the land, bring them into the problem solving to get those percentages of water usage down.
You know, it's the cows. This is the
it
one.
It all comes back to the cows.
It all comes back to the cows. I'm not an expert on any of the topics in this book on agriculture or how to insure, how to invest, how to talk to your children, how to make your house more resilient. This was all based on expert interviews. This is sort of a reporting and explainer job. But the thing about the cows blew me away the most. These animals emit 12 gallons of methane an hour per beast. Methane, wow. As you know, is like carbon dioxide, but 80 times worse as a greenhouse gas blocker, a trapper. So there are one third of the entire Earth's non-frozen land surface is dedicated to cattle grazing. This is why they're burning down the rainforest in Brazil. It's to make more room for cows. And the problem is that what the cows eat per pound would feed eight times as many people. So we're taking, you know, the grain and the corn that we could have eaten, and we're giving them to these animals. So cattle is just, it's a complete disaster from a greenhouse gas perspective and a use of water and a use of land and a use of feed perspective. They're just incredibly, incredibly wasteful. And of course, not really that good for you either.
Well, I was just going to say, David, so I think this brings us back to what we were talking about, large scale versus individual scale changes and the power of that kind of collective action. I mean, is it as simple as in the industrialized, wealthier West, urging people to not eat so many animal products or not to eat so much red meat and lowering the market for that?
It's definitely a start. I mean, there are other ways to go about it too. For example, the restaurant industry has this sort of internal campaign called the protein flip, which is such a great idea. It's this gradual attempt to change American minds from thinking of what's for dinner. Well, it's a slab of an animal in the middle of the plate, to using the meat as more of an accessory, to having bites of beef on the noodles or the rice or in the stir fry. It doesn't have to be this big slab. So it can be, let's have something else twice a week besides beef. You know, it can be a gradual thing. It doesn't mean going full on vegan overnight.
Got it. Call from Connor in northern Minnesota. Hi, Connor. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hello. One thing is I've noticed a migration of animals up here. I'm an avid outdoorsman, and cardinals were never up in the Walker area. And now with the warming winters, as you said earlier, you're starting to see cardinals in the area. And gray squirrels. Gray squirrels were never up here. Another big change is ticks. And that with the winters warming, ticks are able to stay on their hosts, and you're having all these different variety of diseases. You know, you can look into it, and it's they are just terrible. Ticks are the really bad. I don't know.
Yeah,
those are things, you know, I've noticed, and I'm sure that, you know, other outdoorsmen have seen it. Like, we could talk about the bluebills that used to be in the Walker area, Leech Lake area. There used to be millions of them. And then the flyway changed. Well,
right,
why did it change?
Right. Yeah, really good to have your observations from northern Minnesota, Connor. And I think what you were saying about insects, tick-bred diseases, brings us back to where we were at the beginning of the conversation. I mean, David, we started hearing about being more aware and concerned about tick-borne diseases. And I know you're in Connecticut. You saw the impact of Lyme's disease and how it spread through the country. This is, again, kind of that slow, rolling, pretty disastrous effect that all contributes to climate chaos. Do you want to say something about insects and climate?
Oh, I would love to. I would love to talk about ticks.
Good.
I could talk about, after working on this book, I could talk about ticks for hours. My wife says I'm a gas at parties. But yeah, oh my gosh, I'm so glad Connor brought up the tick thing. And Connor actually got the science right about ticks, because it's not that the ticks are moving northward with the warming climate. It's that their transportation, the deer, are moving northward. The ticks that, so I live 20 minutes from Old Lyme, Connecticut. It's, of course, what Lyme disease is named for. Lyme disease is the worst. It's a great imitator. There's no good test for it. If you have it, you can get it for life. If you don't get antibiotics right away, it can just bring you down physically, your joints, your fatigue, and on and on and on. It doesn't always give you the bullseye-shaped rash when you get bitten. And in researching that chapter, I'll just blow your mind with three quick tick factoids. First of all, people say, oh, they're up in the trees. They're going to drop down on you when you're on a hike. Well, no, ticks can't fly. They can't jump. They don't even have eyes. So what they do is they stand on a plant at ground level with their little forearms waving in the air until some critter like you walks by, and then they grab on. You basically can't get Lyme disease until you've had a bite and that thing has stayed on you for 48 hours.
Oh my gosh, so, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, so all you got to do is when you get home, take off your clothes and chuck them in the dryer for 10 minutes, because heat and dehumidity kills ticks like crazy. And while you're standing there naked, look yourself over for anything still attached to you, and you can avoid getting Lyme disease. And also wear DEET when you go hiking, the insect repellent.
Got it. David Pogue is with us. He's the author of How to Prepare for Climate Change, A Practical Guide to Surviving the Chaos. To the phones to Christina in Grand Marais. Christina, really appreciate you waiting through the news break there. How are you?
Great. Thank you so much for taking my call.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I talked to your screener about, you know, wanting to open up the conversation a little bit to equity. I'm hearing a lot about collective action, and I recently moved up to Grand Marais from St. Paul, and we started a group called Zero Waste St. Paul. We were doing a lot of collective action. But in that, and trying to be inclusive, we were realizing, you know, we were really not having a great equity lens in some ways. And, you know, expecting people to have time to do collective action really is a privileged thing to do. And I just wanted to just ask David what he thought about that. And, you know, in this, you know, we also have a lot of, you know, social and economic inequalities. everything's connected. I know this is a big question to ask, but, you know, just wondering maybe a couple bullet points on what he thinks about how equity plays into climate change.
Good. I think this will get us to a different part of the discussion. David?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Climate change, like so many other things, disproportionately affects poorer neighborhoods and communities of color. Many of these neighborhoods were, through redlining and other government policies, set up in low-lying areas and industrial areas. I was reading about Hurricane Katrina, which is, of course, a dramatic example of the changing climate, and disproportionately affected poorer people. And there's this astounding number about the number of people who did not evacuate when ordered to. And, you know, rich people are like, what idiots? Who would sit there with an oncoming hurricane? But of course, 39% of the people who didn't leave couldn't leave. What do you do if you don't have a car? What do you do if you have nowhere to go? You can't book yourself a hotel room. So this is should be at the top of mind in any climate action. And I'm pleased to hear the new president constantly talk about we need to address climate change and we need to do it fairly. In terms of this book, in terms of how you can prepare yourself, fortunately, much of it is simple things that you can do that cost nothing but a little thought. So, for example, one common after effect of any disaster is the cell towers go down, because when there's a power failure, we have no cell service. So over dinner, talk now about how you and your family will get together when there's a disaster if you don't have a cell phone. Say, we'll meet across the street at that craggy tree, or we'll meet at the library or at the grocery store or whatever. Have a plan. I also encourage all of your listeners, anybody, to get this free app. It's from the American Red Cross. It's just called Emergency. And basically, you put in your address, you know, your parents' address, your work address. And from now on, you can forget about the app. Until a disaster is coming, it monitors every kind of weather disaster and man-made disaster, chemical spills and so on, and gives you early warning if any of these things is coming your way. So at least you have an advance notice and you have a little extra time to get prepared and get out.
I want to talk for a minute about China, because they are part of the Paris Climate Accord. They stuck it out even as the U.S. withdrew and then went back in under the Biden administration. You write about China's use of coal, but this is interesting. I think we're used to hearing about how they're bringing so many people into the middle class and, you know, they're using the cheapest energy that they have access to. But you also say that they are extremely aggressive as greenhouse gas emission fighters. What's China doing that the United States should emulate? I think that's an equation we're not used to thinking about.
Yeah, China is sort of sending us mixed signals. The president of China has said that the entire nation will be carbon neutral by 2160, which is astonishing.
That's mind-blowing.
I mean, I don't know if they'll do it. I don't know if we believe it. But the fact that they were able to take that stance and publicly announce it should send a message to all other countries. Yeah, China is by far the largest creator and installer of solar power. They do get much of their power from coal because they have a lot of coal. But the funny thing about the rising middle class there, they don't want filthy air and asthma and cancer either. So they're getting political pushback, too, from the populace about the coal. So things are changing in China. China, of course, is also the source of almost all the technologies that are said to be on the way to help us with climate change. All electric car batteries are made by Asian companies. Much of the lithium that we need in our car batteries comes from mines there. So they're very aggressive. They make most of the wind turbines. They make most of the solar panels. Chinese solar panels are responsible for the incredible price drop in solar panels, an inexpensive quality that we weren't expected to see for another 50 or 100 years. Solar is just absolutely taking over because they're so cheap.
You know, this is something I remember President Obama talking about, David, that we could not seed the greenhouse or the green energy, I should say, technology to the Chinese. And I know we tried to get Congress to act on this. I know progress in the private sector has been made in the United States. But when I hear you go down that list of where China leads, I wonder if the opportunity has just passed us by, and it's irretrievable in some ways.
In manufacturing, I think so. I mean, the United States
really?
Is wow. not able to compete with, you know, the Chinese manufacturing society, but not in policy. For example, in Germany, solar panel is such a big deal because the government gives you rebates, they make them easy to buy, and they make it very easy for you to sell your excess power generated by the panels on your roof back to the utility companies. Mm-hmm. People make money from the sun. And we don't have any kind of federal mandate like that in the United States. And we should. I mean, it would be very easy to make solar incentives so attractive that everybody gets them, which would have a huge effect on our electric consumption.
You report on technology too. What is the best way, do you think, to ignite more innovation? You know, and if we're not going to catch up with the Chinese, to really encourage it, you know, in a moment that seems, you know, we spent the hour talking about the urgency of this moment. So how creative could a Biden administration be to do that?
Very. I think the world is going to decarbonize, right? We are going to stop burning stuff to get our power. Mm-hmm. The finances are on our side here. You know, if you're a utility company, burning coal or oil means buying raw materials, which costs you money, means complying with government regulations, which costs you money. Solar and wind are free forever. You got no raw materials, no smokestack scrubbing to do. But this decarbonization will take 50 or 80 years. And in that process, trillions of dollars are going to change hands. I think that's what the Biden administration is hoping, that because so much money is going to be spent in this effort, that's how we can make it equitable. That's how we can create incentives for creativity and innovation. Once you have that much money streaming through society, people will line up to be in its way, to receive some of that through innovation.
Yeah. A call here from Jeff in Elba, Minnesota. Hi, Jeff. I know it's been a while. I'm so glad you waited because you're a geologist, right?
I am a geologist. I live down in the Bufflins in southeastern Minnesota, and I've been involved in conservation advocacy and activism for over 30 years down here. And
good job.
I want to talk about the winter risks here to our trout streams. Most people don't really get questions a lot of, oh, will our trout streams be destroyed by global warming? And the question and the answer is yes, but not how most people think. Our trout spawn in the winter. They lay their eggs in November, and they do that because they're reliant on crystal clear water for their eggs to hatch and the fry to survive. Mm-hmm. And if it rains or we have runoff events in the middle of the winter, we lose the entire year class of trout.
Wow.
They're all killed. In the last 4 years, we've had winter rains around Christmas time twice.
Mm-hmm.
And the trout have to have that cold, clear water with no runoff until mid-February at least, or into March, for them to survive.
And so, I assume, Jeff, when you got into the field, that wasn't a problem, right? That we would get rain in the middle of the winter.
No. And truth be told, I'm guilty. When I got in the field, I was a petroleum geologist. So I'm working on
really?
my guilt.
Yeah. You've come a long way.
But I'm now on the board of directors of a number of organizations, the National Trout Center, the Minnesota Well Owners Organization, and Fresh Energy.
Jeff, working on all of these if areas. I might, I would like to – it's really – insightful to hear your experience with watching what happens with the trout hatches. I think, David, this brings us back to us talking a little bit at the beginning about the asset of having fresh water. I've wondered if that is going to become, you know, at the moment, the Sun Belt is growing like crazy. I mean, where do big companies even, you know, decide to put up a new headquarters? You know, places like Austin, Texas. And yet I wonder if it is going to become so valuable to have this access to fresh water that, I don't know, 30 years from now, the Sun Belt is not the burgeoning place and people are living in kind of our, what we think of sometimes as uninhabitable winters. Can you?
I guarantee it.
Yeah.
I guarantee it. The hot places, the hurricane places, I mean, already real estate values are changing in Miami. Yes, they're still developing in Miami, but they're tending to site these buildings farther back from the coast. Already in Miami, a house on the water goes for 14% lower real estate value than the identical house farther up the hill because wow. Flooding and sea level rise are an issue. In Arizona, there are so many people leaving Phoenix because of the brutal heat and moving to Flagstaff, which is at 7,000 feet elevation and much cooler. The people of Flagstaff joke about building a wall to keep them out. So there is no question. There may be a delayed effect. It may be taking longer than we would expect for the numbers to start dropping. But people have studied. There's a great graph in the book that shows the projected population shift in the United States because of climate change in the next 30 years. And the hotter states are going to be the big losers, Florida in particular.
You know, I wanted to ask you about zoning, too, because this really has to be part of the conversation about what this is going to cost Americans and, you know, people around the world collectively. I mean, we look at cities like New Orleans and Des Moines and others who are pouring money into infrastructure because they're trying to fend off floodwaters. But we also see plenty of coastal cities saying, sure, you build that new community of condos right on the coast. And I think you quote this FEMA statistic that says by 2100, the flood vulnerable areas of the U.S. are going to grow by something like 40-45%. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. The number of people living in flood zones. Yeah.
I mean, so these are some of the unpopular decisions the people that lead cities and counties and states are going to have to make, and citizens may not like it in the short term. We come back to political will. I wonder if you see much of that happening in, you know, in different areas around the country.
There actually is so much going on. I mean, I would have been described as somebody with eco despair when I started writing this book. There is so much action, even among the members of our slow, clumsy government. You know, flood insurance, which, by the way, your homeowner's insurance doesn't cover flooding. Mm-hmm. Flood right. insurance is managed almost exclusively by the government because regular insurance companies wouldn't touch it. It's a losing business. And they run this thing called the National Flood Insurance Program. FEMA runs it. And it's so antiquated. It's $25 billion in debt. The rates that you pay are way out of whack because they don't take climate change into account or even current trends of flooding into account. But this October, they are going to completely revamp this program. And what it will do will make it really a bad idea to build in floodplains. It will have a chilling effect on all this development that you're talking about because you won't be able to get insurance that's reasonably priced if you're going to build in a dangerous place. So little by little, we are seeing eyes being opened.
I mean, there's already a lot of construction there, but this is hopeful. I wasn't aware of that. So more of the coastline will remain undeveloped until it's abandoned because, you know, however long that takes, right? 30, 40, 50 years, because people simply can't live that close to to rising sea level.
That's right. And by the way, FEMA has also bought 50,000 homes, bought out the homeowner, and then knocked your house down because that is actually cheaper for the government than continuing to pay you your insurance to rebuild flooded homes. In California, they are now no longer letting you build right up next to the forest. They've learned their lesson from the wildfires. So all over the dangerous places of the United States, governments are trying to dissuade people from building foolishly, and that will have an effect.
I don't think we can end our conversation without talking about carbon pricing, because as you know, experts say it's really only the only serious way to move with the kind of speed that we need to move. Political will, oh my gosh, it's hard to imagine when Congress would get on board with this. But I wonder if you agree with that idea, that it is going to take something huge and painful like carbon pricing to really get us to where we should be.
It doesn't have to be painful. There's this amazing plan, bipartisan, by ex-government officials, both Republican and Democrat, to start building carbon pollution into the prices of goods and services. And the tax collected from that would go into our pockets. We would get a check in our bank account every month collected from the corporate polluters. This plan is super popular among voters, obviously. Both Republicans and Democrats love it. And most experts, as you say, they say that some kind of carbon pricing scheme really is inevitable. It would greatly accelerate our transition to a decarbonized society. And it's more or less inevitable. So I think more people are talking about it. It's going to be a long road, a politically hard road, but it's not dead yet.
Yeah. I mean, let's just note here in the minute or so we have left. I mean, part of the issue is the rhetoric that leads up to some kind of legislation on that. Like, right, your electricity is going to be much more expensive. The false kind of political rhetoric, I think, gets in the way of some kind of action on it. Just a quick thought on that, David.
Yes. That's my quick thought. you're
yes.
Right. Yes, you're right. you nailed it.
David, thank you. This has been really insightful. Good to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!